After 4 months of recording episodes for the FinTech OG series, it is here, and I am so excited for you guys to tune in. We are kicking it off with Matt Harris of Bain Capital and Steve McLaughlin of FT Partners, which if you're in FinTech, I don't even think these guys need an introduction, but I will give you their bios in a hot sec. We dive into everything from how they got into FinTech, why they've stayed in the space, and if they still think FinTech is a good place to join. You'll also find out how a golden retriever named Audrey has shaped fintech investing as we know it. Definitely stay tuned for that. We also have a couple of ads from our friends at FS Vector as well as Empire Startups. Definitely check both of them out. I have them linked in the show notes as well. But tune in, subscribe to make sure you don't miss a single episode. We will be sending it out in the email, but you know, just in case you missed the email, Apple, Spotify, wherever you listen to podcasts, go hit subscribe and like any episode that you tune into and find interesting. And I can't wait to hear from you guys. I'm excited for these. Hey everyone, so I've known the FS Vector team since my early days in fintech when I'd reach out to them to ask about all things compliance and policy while covering fintech at Bloomberg. Since then, they've been a staple in my conversations, and a number of the companies that I work with are using them as a valuable resource for any of their consulting needs. FS Vector's advisory team has helped hundreds of companies launch financial products by advising on product structure, finding and establishing a relationship with a partner bank, and even standing up necessary compliance programs. In doing so, FS Vector felt that compliance and risk management training really didn't need to be a thing that employees detested, but something that they enjoyed doing. So that's why they recently went and built out their own training curriculum and a platform called Headmaster. Now, Headmaster is filled with relevant, accurate, and role-specific content specifically tailored to each fintech's unique needs. It also provides timely regulatory updates and frequent tips on uplifting areas of compliance and risk management. So if you're looking to launch a new product and in need of compliance support, or you're just looking for a training platform, go to fsvector.com or click the link in the show notes for their contact information. Matt Harris is a partner at Bain Capital Ventures in New York City, where he focuses on investments in financial technology. He sees a huge amount of revenue, profit, and market cap shifting from regulated financial institutions to entrepreneur-led insurgents across payments, lending, capital markets, real estate, and insurance. Matt started his career at Bain Capital Private Equity in 1995, having worked previously at Bain & Co. and attending Williams College, where he majored in political economy. In 2000, Matt founded Village Ventures, which he ran for 12 years and focused on early-stage fintech investing. In 2012, he rejoined Bain Capital Ventures. Outside of work, Matt enjoys spending any free moments with his wife, Jessica, and their 6 children. God bless you, Matt. Matt serves as a trustee of Williams College as well as a member of the college's investment committee and co-head of the non-marketable assets committee and is a former chair of the board of the Williamstown Theater Festival. Steve McLaughlin is the founder and CEO of FT Partners and a former senior banker at Goldman Sachs covering fintech and financial services for over 20 years. Steve was ranked number 1 on Institutional Investor's Most Influential Dealmakers in FinTech Report and named Investment Banker of the Year, as well as ranked number 1 FinTech Banker in Silicon Valley by The Information. FT Partners was founded in late 2001 and has won Investment Banking Firm of the Year 4 times since 2004. Steve has personally led and closed hundreds of FinTech M&A, capital raise, and IPO advisory transactions.
I had like plug-in headphones, and turns out I do for my iPhone, but they don't go to my computer. So am I sounding okay? Am I ruining the podcast?
Yeah, you're good. Okay. No, you sound
you're sounding as good as you can, Steve. Yeah. I mean,
it's the best I can do. Exactly.
Well, I'm so excited to record an episode with both of you. Who's actually been in fintech longer, Matt or Steve?
Steve.
Really? Oh, man.
Well, he's a lot older. It's not obvious looking. I mean, but he's a lot older. I mean, he's very old. So
very old. Very old.
He's got that advantage.
If I want to make myself sound old in fintech, I mean, I'd probably start doing it in like 95, actually.
Yeah.
That's how I think of you at Goldman. Like, you were the really
it was the earliest possible days of, you know, the internet and financial services, like the online banking, like Chip Mahan, S1, Security First Bank was like.
PayPal wasn't even invented in 1995, were they?
What was?
PayPal wasn't even around.
No,
then. Yeah.
No.
You're pre-PayPal fintech. Wow.
Pre-PayPal, yeah. But you know, everyone forgets, like, there was ATM machines, there was credit cards, and somebody was processing insurance claims. You know, it just wasn't hot, you know. And then, you know, when the internet became a thing, everyone was like, let's just internetize everything, you know, and there was that boom, right? The branches are going away and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So, yeah. And then it all plummeted.
What was it that you saw back then that you thought was so cool about fintech that you wanted to dive in? Because like you said, like fintech wasn't cool back then.
It was an underappreciated area at Goldman. Like, they were really masters of the universe of working on really large financial services deals. But all the dot-com stuff was the rage, and they were all companies with less than $5 million, $10 million in revenue. So nobody was really paying attention to it. And then it kind of caught fire in like larger companies, like exchanges and payment platforms that were embedded in banks became, you know, interesting too, because e-commerce revenue was going to, you know, was going to be there. So it was just nobody was focused on it at all. And, you know, that was my entree. Have we started the podcast yet?
Yeah, we're just rolling.
Oh, this is it. We're in the middle of it. Okay.
Yeah.
I thought we were just shooting shit before we got going.
No, we're shooting the shit the entire time.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's how it should feel. You're getting that part
okay.
right.
Okay, good. Okay, you shouldn't. That's funny. All right, good. Well, here we are. Welcome to the podcast. Nice to see you guys.
I'll cut that and move it to the intro, and that'll be the intro for this one. Matt, were you pre or post PayPal fintech?
I would say post. I think of PayPal and the X.com merger as being, I'm going to get it wrong, but 99. I mean, it was late 90s and not into the 2000s. And I was really a like 2001 guy. I mean, my first fintech investment was 1996 when we bought TRW Credit. Steve, that'll resonate with you. It was the credit bureau that was owned by Midwestern industrial conglomerate TRW for no good reason, and Bain Capital bought it and turned it into Experian. And I spent, you know, a proper year of my life in Orange County buying it first and then doing all this transformation work. And so I guess I could backdate it to then, but that's not legitimate. I then just went and was like an internet VC for a few years, when that seemed like a legitimate thing to call yourself. And it was only after the dot-com bust, you know, sort of middle of 2000, I was looking at the wreckage around me and thinking like, well, this generalist thing is not going to work for me. Like, I need to stand for something if I'm going to make a career in this business. And I stitched together a few experiences I had, including the Experian one, and said, like, nobody in venture land seems to care about these categories, payments, lending, asset management, wealth management, insurance. So, like, maybe I'll just camp out there and hope the direction of travel goes my way.
What, just out of curiosity, what else could have gotten you? Like, what, maybe it sounds like fintech might not have had Matt Harris in it. What would have been another avenue that you would have gone down?
Yeah, I mean, it would literally, like, I had, you know, I was 26 and the only, like, dependent or partner in my life was a golden retriever named Audrey, and I literally went away with Audrey and sat and thought about it. I thought about, you know, climate was starting to be a thing. Healthcare was probably the next obvious one. My parents are both physicians, and honestly, that was like a real negative for me. Like, I was like, oh, shit, I just don't want to be like. It just seemed like so burdensome, so hectic, like the aspect of human life being on the line and the sort of physical safety stuff seemed like a real negative. And I was really ticking through industries, but, you know, by size, there were VCs, you know, the industry hadn't really gone vertical at that point. So you had a lot of, you know, either IT or healthcare. But there were some specialists within IT. There were people who knew cybersecurity extremely well, et cetera. So those didn't seem like greenfield opportunities. And so I was left with this, like, you know, list of categories of the GDP. And boy, financial services sticks out. I mean, it is big and highly profitable. And then the other thing is it's highly complex. I mean, I really, one of the perils of focus is the idea that you really get bored. And I, you know, at least that point in my life got bored pretty easily. And so I comforted myself with the idea that, frankly, payments is not all that similar to capital markets, which is very different than insurance. And so it fits it nicely in a rubric of fintech and financial services. But within that is a lot of really heterogeneous type problems. So after this analysis that Audrey and I did over a weekend, we both decided financial services was going to be it. And then fintech, I kind of resisted that word for a long time because, I don't know, it just struck me as like a kind of a marginalization of what was happening.
You remember the first time you heard the phrase fintech?
I had heard fintech was used sometimes to describe like First Data and the other processors and some of the kind of capital markets focused tech companies were called fintech. The first modern usage of fintech was really Square.
Okay.
That's what I remember of, like, people started talking about fintech in a venture context was LendingClub, Prosper, Square, you know, kind of 06, 07. And then at that point I had a real antipathy to it because it felt, again, I was like, this, you know, Square isn't a fintech company. It's a really important merchant acquirer. You know, like this, we don't have to have a new term for this. Like, these are big industries that are being transformed by these technology driven, entrepreneurially led companies. Like, let's not create this ghetto and call it fintech, but you can't fight the weather. So I started talking about fintech myself for sure. And, you know, shortly thereafter.
It's funny, back in 95, it was called FigTech at Goldman. Because the group was called Financial Institutions Group, and we didn't know what to call it, so we just like tacked the word tech on. So they used FigTech even well into when it was called FinTech. It was always FigTech. And then it was, you know, e-finance, i-finance, you know, e-brokerage. It was an E or an I in front of everything, i-banking. And then it was financial technology when we started Financial Technology Partners. And then at some point, you know, FinTech kind of leaked in there. And I don't actually remember. I keep thinking I'm going to go through my emails one day and find out when's the first time that it ever popped up in my inbox. And that would be pretty much it. So, because, yeah, I go way back on that stuff. But yeah, no, I mean, Matt, you're a lot smarter than me. You actually picked the sector. I was in the Fig group at Goldman, and I just got thrown into it and saw it, like, right out the corner of my eyeball. But that was an amazing ride up. And it's funny, you guys talk about PayPal being some sort of seminal point, and I guess it was to some extent because, you know, you got the PayPal mafia and you got Elon Musk doing all of this fun stuff. But, you know, I think it's funny that, you know, PayPal, first of all, is a merger of two different companies, which, you know, we could talk about in this era, there should be lots of mergers of similar companies to create PayPal-like outcomes. But also, the funny thing was PayPal sold, you know, probably in 2001 or so for just over $1 billion, right? And I think they had raised $500 million. So for all this hoopla that PayPal gets for having, you know, done something amazing, it always kind of cracked me up. It, you know, sold for what we all consider a unicorn today as being pretty commonplace, right? Maybe less so today. And then, of course, it went on to become worth a lot more than that over the course of time. So I always look at PayPal as a bit of a history of the fintech and what it's become, and also that became an incumbent, right, that then fell down. So it's just an interesting case study over the course of time.
Hi, fintech friends. Okay, mark your calendars for the event happening during New York Fintech Week, the 2024 Empire Fintech Conference. Picture this, a day jam-packed with masterclasses, live demos, inspiring keynotes, riveting live podcasts, and unparalleled networking opportunities. Join over 700 attendees, myself included, on Wednesday, April 10th, and immerse yourself at the forefront of fintech innovation. As a special treat to our listeners, aka you can use code FINTECHOG for 15% off at checkout. Just go to empirestartups.com to grab your ticket today.
Well, one other thing I want to dive into is we're kind of reflecting on much earlier point in fintech, when you initially got into this space, what is something that you thought would have been solved for by 2024, but guess what? We're here and it hasn't been solved yet.
The underbanked, you know, this was really like one of the original themes in the first decade of at least my fintech career, kind of 2000 to 2010. Prepaid was one of the sort of quote unquote novel, you know, technologies that was making a difference. And part of the raison d'etre of prepaid as an alternative to traditional debit and credit was that it accommodated the unbanked and the underbanked. And if you that was really one of the most important themes that everyone was working on. There were whole firms, Arjun Shute, you know, and all these folks like organized themselves to tackle this opportunity and this problem. And like, I don't know. I still sit here and think like, okay, where are the big companies that came out of that? You know, there was Netspend and some of the early reloadable prepaid folks, but they really kind of gave way to the neobanks on more modern platforms. We had a company called TXVIA, which was an issuer processor, kind of an early Marqeta in that space. We sold it to Google, but there haven't been huge companies built on that theme. You could argue Cash App is the biggest single, you know, entity focused on the underbanked. And as
why do you think we haven't been able to solve that yet? Because it's
hard to make money off.
I was going to say there's plenty of companies that have tried, just none of them have seemed to get it right.
Yeah, I mean, it's really hard to make money from people who don't have a lot of money.
Without taking all their money, right? And so a lot of the bank platforms have just been like, okay, we're just going to take 3% of your money every day until you're broke, right? And, you know, whatever for money transfer or whatever. You know, you do see like slivers of lots and lots of companies that have solved micro parts of the problem, but you haven't seen a big company. Like Remitly would be a good example of one where they're really, really, really doing good things for the underbanked and they actually have a mission, they care. And I'm not just saying that because we've raised all the money for them. Our client, we're friends with those guys, we love them. But that's one of the reasons that we love them is that they're actually really doing good things for, you know, people that need that kind of help. And so I think you haven't really found anyone that has created like the ultimate amazing super app, you know, for this population. But I think if you kind of cut through 100 companies, there's, you know, little parts of it that are, you know, essentially serving them. But that part of the economy, they don't really attune themselves well to super apps. There's no one company that's been able to sell them car insurance, title loans, you know, cash advances, etc. So I was going to say, by the way, that the part that I've seen not solved is somewhat along those lines, but also just this, it's the fact that the incumbents have become, you know, as good in some cases as the startups. Like, I mean, like if you're an internet bank in the US and all you want to do is checking and savings, I mean, pretty hard to beat JPMorgan Chase's checking and savings platform. It's pretty good. B of A's got a good one. There's all sorts of features, functions, Ally Bank. You know, there's the technology companies servicing the incumbents, and the incumbents themselves have become pretty good at this kind of stuff. So, you know, you really haven't seen outside of Chime any kind of a, you know, mega, you know, internet bank, if you will, or internet super app, or, you know, mobile super app. And that thing has kind of surprised me, you know, is that no one's really cracked the code. And look, I love Chime. I think it's great. But they do have a limited number of products. They're not really in lending. They're not offering many products more than checking, direct deposit, and some early wage access. You know, but you know, you look at Revolut in Europe, you know, they've got 100 products and they're in 100 countries and they're doing billions of dollars of revenue and massively profitable and growing 100% a year. And Nubank in Brazil. But so somehow, you know, little old Brazil, you know, created a $40 billion, you know, digital bank and market cap wise. And, you know, UK, you know, company that people kind of, you know, give a hard time to, Revolut, it created this, you know, could be hundreds of billions of dollars down the road. But like in the US, we really don't have, you know, something like that. I mean, Chime's the closest thing, but it's a single double product app. Again, we love, you know, Chris and Mark and the guys there, but like ultimately it's just shocked that there hasn't been something worth hundreds of billions of dollars in the US around digital banking. And part of that's because the big banks have pretty good technology. I mean, it's not great, but it gets the job done.
Yeah, no, same as story in wealth, where I think if you roll the clock back 15 years, you know, Betterment and Wealthfront were very early movers. And, you know, it just hasn't worked. I mean, you know, the same story with the incumbents had an ability to react. And so the biggest, you know, biggest digital bank is JP Morgan, and the biggest robo-advisor is Schwab. You know, there was insufficient innovation to provide a real barrier to entry for the incumbents, taking their sweet time, but eventually getting there.
There's not that many stories. If you think about it, let's just talk about it for a second, Matt. Like, what companies have actually created huge market caps and disrupted incumbents in the last 15 years? So call it like pre-financial crisis to today, right? And it's Stripe. I mean, they're clearly, at least on paper, worth 50 plus billion. Square's worth, you know, 30 plus billion. You know, you've got Adyen. It's a good example. I mean, they were created more than 15 years ago. But, you know, those are all payments companies, right? And so, you know, but you have banking, insurance, lending, broadly speaking, you know, you really haven't seen it.
Would you consider Plaid part of that, though?
Yeah, but I mean, you know, I again, love Plaid, but, you know, they're powering all these fintechs and, you know, so on and so forth. And I don't, you know,
or necessarily Apex Clearing?
Great companies. These are all great companies, right? But they're a little bit of a, look, I'll put them in the category. Yeah, they definitely created a huge amount of enterprise value relative to the amount of capital they raised. So I would count those guys in there, right? But, you know, you're really kind of struggling to find that many that are $10 billion. They're clearly $10 billion and above. There's Circle, right? You know, on the USDC side, I saw, Matt, you've been talking a bit about stablecoins these days. So, you know, we're big fans of those guys, and that could be a completely game-changing company. It already is. But, like, you just haven't seen that many despite gajillions of dollars going. You've seen a lot of people sell for $500 million, $2 billion, $3 billion, you know, but you haven't seen massive spaces get disrupted. I mean, Bill.com is one of them, right? Bill.com. You know, but you notice they're all B2B, right? And they're not, they're really, no one's been able to touch the consumer side. I mean, there's Chime, right? But, you know, Chime would be really the good example of a B2C company. People sometimes forget about Intuit. You know, Intuit wasn't like a startup in this whole world, but it went from being a single-digit billion-dollar company to a $170 billion company under everyone's, you know, nose. You know what I mean? Like, it's like the least noisy company that created the maybe the best or one of the best fintech companies around, right? So it's, people tend to forget about them all the time, but that's an amazing story.
Yep. I agree with that. I think a payroll category, payroll and benefits, Gusto, Rippling, JustWorks, they're, to my knowledge, based on the numbers I see, all on a trajectory to be north of $10 billion. But the incumbents they're disrupting are older companies, ADP, Paychex, enormous, very valuable companies, but so far been, you know, haven't accepted any newcomers into their ranks north of $10 billion of like recognized market cap.
Right.
And then pure play lenders, forget about it.
It's mostly all B2B. It's mostly all B2B, right? And I think what people are realizing is it's really hard to create a consumer brand in the United States and anywhere else for that matter without spending billions and billions of dollars. And it's been really hard to do.
Yeah, Coinbase. Let's not sleep on Coinbase.
Some of them Coinbase. Have like consumer aspects to them, like Square, but Square is largely a B2B play for sure.
It became B2C a little bit more on Cash App, right? So I think Cash App standalone becomes, you know, a great story. But you know, outside of Square, it might not have existed. So there are some. But what's interesting to find is, like, you know, that it's very, very hard. The incumbents have a lot of money to invent technology, and things don't happen overnight either, right? So incumbents see something coming. Jamie Dimon saying Silicon Valley is coming. Well, he didn't sit around and do nothing. You know, they build out what they needed to build out, right? And look, we are forgetting about a lot of other companies like Market Access. If you want to get into like, you know, fixed income trading, they're worth $20 billion plus or minus. And so there's a lot of them, but like, again, they're mostly B2B.
What would you say have been, going back to you guys on an individual level in this space, what have been some of the key decisions that you've made to get you to the point where you're extremely recognized individuals when you're talking about fintech?
Never quitting, never stopping, and always kind of like building your own personal LLM in your own brain about what's going on, just sucking as much information as possible. It becomes more and more valuable every year. And so, you know, just sticking at it has been the thing that's been the most powerful. You type M. Harris at Bain Capital Ventures, you're going to get Matt. You do Steve at FT Partners, you're going to get Steve, and we can get you to the team, and so on, and so can Matt. But so it's a, you know, a name, a brand, high quality, being there, you know, not changing firms every few years, you know, not, you know, being a flash in the pan, but, and also I think being a reasonable zealot for the space, right? You know, we both believe in it. We also know there's a lot of fluff in it as well. I'll speak for myself anyway, but, you know, you really say, where's the flight to quality? Where's the quality? And you're always trying to work with the quality companies. And, yeah, we're super proud of our client base over the course of time and the results. And, you know, at this point, our whole business is word of mouth. You know, all of our clients are referrals from somebody else. So it's a, that's a lucky break, you know.
I don't know about lucky, but I would say well-deserved. I just echo something Steve said. I think we're in a boom and bust business, you know, technology entrepreneurship more generally, fintech even more so. And crypto is the most extreme example of this, right? Crypto doesn't just go in and out of, you know, positive cycles. It goes in and out of favor. And frankly, every 2 years since we started doing it in 2013, it's literally left for dead and embarrassing. And then it comes back. And so the sort of pot committed nature that Steve and I have chosen for ourselves, of like, it really doesn't matter if other people like it or not. This is what we're doing. It's actually, at this point, like a kind of an identity matter. It is who we are. I remember in 2006, my wife was like, you know what, maybe don't talk about work so much at cocktail parties. I don't know that people are that interested in this payments thing, you know, or whatever, you know, like, but look, we're just not doing it to be cool. And that's, you know, stick-to-itiveness or stubbornness or whatever you want to call it, which is most acutely recognized, I think, in crypto circles because everyone else just bails, is also true within fintech, where there are a lot of tourists. And in 2021, whether it be investment bankers competing with Steve for business or venture capitalists competing with me for deals, you know, founders had a pretty stark choice whether they wanted somebody who, you know, learned the difference between acquiring and issuing, you know, yesterday so that they could, you know, try to make their way through a meeting, and somebody who, you know, has almost literally written books about that. So not every founder wants an expert, but most founders do want somebody who's as committed as they are. And so if there's a single, you know, best thing, I think, about the longevity and the tactics and strategies that Steve and I have both deployed, it's just been not blowing with the wind and being committed to kind of a lifetime of financial services innovation and in a bunch of different flavors. And I think founders have a way of recognizing that.
I think also being, you know, just, you know, highly ethical, you know, always doing the right thing, knowing that if you do the wrong thing, it'll come back and bite you, right? And, you know, you just live on your reputation. You literally have nothing but that. And so, you know, when you think long-term like that, like we're always telling our clients, think long-term. Don't do what you think is going to be the right thing to get a deal done. Build the business you think is going to be, you know, something you never want to sell and people are going to want to buy it, you know? And that's kind of how we thought about building FT Partners. Do the right thing, be long-term thinking. I just was on the phone with a client this morning and they're like, look, we don't want to do anything right now. You know, I said, that's fine. We worked with companies for 2-3 years prior to them doing something, never send a bill, generally speaking. And when they're ready to do something, we're 100% ready. So when you have a long-term mindset like that, you're not operating for the 12/31, you know, revenue bonus or whatever, you know, and our whole firm is like in that mindset of like, how do we add like long-term value? How do we get recurring clients? And you only get that by doing the right thing. And like, Matt's the same way. This is a huge, you know, compliment to Matt. But I mean, everybody wants Matt and Bain Capital to be their investor in the stages that he invests at. And I will call them, you know, people would easily be willing to take a 25% less valuation or whatever it is, you know, to get a high quality investor. And it's one of the few people I've ever met that everyone actively says that. And unfortunately, he doesn't have unlimited bandwidth or unlimited capital or can't give everyone money, so he's got to be super incredibly selective. But, you know, he's just built that brand. And there's a couple people out there like that, you know, maybe, you know, the Nigels of the world and Nigel Morris's, and you're just like super amazing people, but it's rare. And so it's all reputation, you know. And a lot of firms, like, you know, I don't know, Andreessen Horowitz and others have like armies of people that they throw at you to, you know, marketing extras and this kind of extra. And Bain's got those guys too, but, you know, Matt's got a brand of his own. So it's, that's the thing I've been most impressed with Bain. So, and Matt, you know, so good for you. Yeah.
I'm really enjoying this podcast. I just want to say this. Really,
exactly. I can do this every day. Send this to your mother, and she'll be proud of you. She'll finally know what you do or whatever, and your siblings, but yeah.
Matt, if you were having that conversation with Audrey again, imagine like you're young, you're with Audrey, like a pivotal moment in your career. Is fintech still a good place to join, or would you tell that person to explore other things that are out there right now that might not have been back then?
You know, I think if I abstract away from the fintech decision, you know, in 2000, it was really a decision about vertical specialization. And I think I could have picked a lot of different verticals when so few people had any specialization, you know, and in that immature stage of the venture industry, just becoming a specialist, that was the single biggest decision. And then which one I picked, I think I got really lucky on. But there were other roads to glory just by standing out in what at that time was a highly undifferentiated field. That opportunity is gone. You know, fintech, now there are dozens of very high-quality people who specialize within fintech, but that same is true of every vertical. You know, maybe not dozens, but there's plenty of folks. Like, that story is out about, for a young person looking to find their way in venture, you know, verticalization is the first thing that comes to mind. So I would be thinking more radically about how to build a career in venture. Maybe it's about a source of talent that you can develop, that you could bring as an asset to your companies. Maybe it's about a source of founders, a network of founders that you have this ability to build distinctive access to. But I doubt that, you know, picking a vertical, whether it be financial services or another one right now, is the bold move in venture. I think that's more the tried and true. But if you're going to do it, the thing about financial services is it's still huge. There are still massive unsolved problems. There are niches upon niches upon niches where you can actually be, you know, if you work hard, you could be smarter than even the veterans by digging into the right niche and becoming even smarter. As we saw in crypto, it's really not the old school financial services folks. It's a whole new crop of young people who figure that out first and most profoundly in most cases. So I think it's a terrific vertical if you're convinced you want to be vertically focused. But before I committed to that, I'd start thinking about what are the dimensions of differentiation that aren't played out yet?
Steve, what if you're that young guy at Goldman again, do you think fintech is still a good place to join, or would you try to deal your hand somewhere else?
I mean, I got to echo most of the stuff, or if not all the stuff Matt was saying. I mean, I really do believe in specialization. Like Michael Jordan, you know, specialized in basketball. He became really good. We tried baseball, not so much, right? And, you know, so you got to specialize in something. And I tell our young people that all the time, whether it is, you know, fintech or clean tech or something else, like, you know, just get good at something. You know, we're not all Elon Musk and can run seven companies at the same time and have, you know, all this kind of stuff. But yeah, I definitely think it'd be good to get in. But I think it's as good to get in today as it was when we both got in. Because at the end of the day, financial services, as Matt said, a massive, massive, massive part of the GDP. But back when we got in, it was pretty much domestic, right? We weren't probably thinking international, right? I mean, like right now, you know, when we think of GDP, we think of like global domestic product, right? And you've got Africa and India, and we're doing deals in Africa, in India. We're selling a company in Japan right now, and sold in Korea and Egypt and Turkey and Saudi Arabia and, you know, Australia. I mean, you know, there's, you know, anywhere in the world, fintech becomes, it's a different version of what it is here. It's either advanced in some areas, far behind in some areas, super adopted in some areas, and, you know, and in Europe, it's so interesting and exciting of a space, you know. But the reason to say it's as interesting today, it's the space is, it's far bigger, it's far more recognized, but I still don't think there's that many people in investment banker land or VC land that truly understand it, right? They jumped on the bandwagon, but you don't really find too many people with more than 5 years experience as VCs in the space, and their 5 years experience is now marred with a bunch of overpriced companies that they're going to be licking their wounds on. And I'm not going to name names, so there's people leaving funds left and right and center now. Fintech guys have blew themselves up. You know, one of the things I was again, Matt, you should just pay me for this stuff. But like one of the things Matt told me, like in all of like 21, he did one deal, right? Tiger, you know, and others did hundreds of deals. You know what I mean? Like you really want to be conservative when the market's going crazy. And, you know, not many people have that kind of discipline. So a lot of people blew themselves up. So it's not like the experience that people have is that good, right, in a lot of ways. So we look at our competitors, and it's like, well, gee, in the last 10 years, you know, Lehman blew up, Bear Stearns blew up, Merrill Lynch blew up, now Credit Suisse, and, you know, it's a whole bunch of boutiques have been, you know, kind of flopped and gone out of business. And I've seen at least 15 fintech boutiques start up and fade during the last 15 years, and it's harder than it looks. And so, yeah, I tell the young people in our company, you know, because it's a little nerve-wracking because business isn't as good anywhere right now. I don't care if you're at Goldman Sachs or anywhere, unless you're in NVIDIA or you know, Apple, you know, things are a little tricky these days. And I would say, look, that's the environment that I entered into fintech, right? It was a dot-com bust. It was a complete disaster. But that's great. That's when there's a huge washout. That's when, you know, bankers are getting laid off. If you're people are moving firms, groups are getting fragmented. And I think I'm really excited about is all of that starting all over again. Is there's huge, huge lessons learned from the last 5 or 7 or 8 years of things that didn't work. And I think people are smart enough to realize we're not going to make hopefully any of those mistakes going forward, right? So it's good to learn all those negative things that did not work. You know, no one's going to start trying to create like a, you know, telematics based, you know, auto insurance company, you know, going consumer direct, right? It's really hard, right, to build a $100 billion company doing that, you know, because you turn on the TV and there's 100 commercials from other auto insurance companies. Not that there aren't people that have done well there are, but, you know, I think going forward, I'm not going to get into detail, but the models that we're seeing are more B2B2C. There's things you can do to leverage existing infrastructure, existing advertising networks, existing data sources, existing sources of capital. You don't need to do everything yourself, right? And that's a little hard. Even Tesla, when it started, you know, it used a Lotus body, frame, wheels, everything else. It just stuck the battery in the engine, right? Had they tried to do everything they want, they'd have never, they barely succeeded with that plan, right? And so, but now they're building everything themselves, and it's been many, many years, or most things anyway. So I think that the key to success post this fintech apocalypse we've just had is learning what didn't work and leveraging the things that did work, right? And I think with that, you're going to see the TAMs as big as they ever been, but you'll see more resilient companies getting in. They'll require less capital, and they will create, I think, very good returns on the back end. That's why you're seeing so many seed Series A and even Series B deals right now, because that's where people are putting the money, because those companies have never got themselves into deep water like everybody else has. And they're, you know, either didn't start the company until they saw what was wrong, or they pivoted early.
Yeah, first of all, that was brilliant, Steve. And I got inspired listening to you. And
I'm going
to
send each of you a bill for the marketing you're giving each other on this.
They cancel out. It's fine.
I don't think I'm known for pandering. So, I mean, at least people listening can tell that it's genuine. But it's a really inspiring time. I mean, it has been a crappy time for new deals for the last 3 years. The first year of which, there were a lot of deals to do and they were all terrible. And then the most recent couple of years, there hasn't been much to do because companies were just kind of recovering. And I think that fallow period just, you know, it's washed a lot of folks out, as Steve said. And I think if I were a young person right now and I was committed to choosing a vertical, financial services, it's a time for really fresh thinking. And that's, you know, the dogmas have all been kind of overthrown. And you can go back to basics and old principles and old thinking, which is the temptation for an old dog like me. But much more interesting is to take a white sheet of paper and say, like, all right, well, there probably will be new consumer insurance options in the world, right? We know there were a lot of failures, as Steve, you know, obliquely referenced. But, like, what's the way to do it that's actually novel and creates disruptive value? And you could take every one of the 40 or so large niches that we follow within financial services and ask that same question, because there's so few clear success stories from the past, you know, half decade, I'll argue. And that is an amazing opportunity for a young investor or a young founder.
You take something like insurance, like Matt said. We all know going direct to consumer is tough. Lemonade, Clover, I mean, you name it, right? It's been really tough. You know, you look at now something like, I don't know, Sure. There's all these embedded insurance plays, right? Where it's like, why would I go create a direct to consumer? Why don't I just enable, you know, everybody out there that's already talking to consumers about other things and has tons of data, tons of access? Why don't I just embed that into the workflow of those businesses so they can offer insurance straight away? Auto dealers, auto rental companies, you know, whatever the case may be. I mean, actually, auto rental is probably the best example. Like, you rent a car, you click here, you get your insurance. I mean, there's no agent, there's no nothing, and you're paying ridiculous prices for it. You know, I think everything's going to go, there's so much going to go B2B to C, and there'll be a few, you know, epic B2C companies, B2C companies. But yeah, it's just an amazing moment in time. And look, there's still deals getting done, and not to toot anyone's horn here, but like we just raised, you know, a couple $100 million for Built Technologies in this sort of reward space. It's a B2B to C play, right? You know, they go and sign up a massive number of apartment buildings, get every consumer or renter in the apartment building, enable them to pay all their rent via credit card, build their credit, go around and effectively, you know, gain rewards through paying the rent and by using local merchants. So like everybody wins. So that they've got millions and millions and millions of consumers engaged and millions of businesses, but it's all B2B to C. It's all happening in the natural course of people's activities. These things are happening. So it'll be too hard to go to each consumer and say, hey, I know you're in this building. Would you want to pay rent by this? And would you want to get this? It's these things have to happen in the natural course of things. I think in financial services, I think in particular financial services, you don't see too many network effects. You do see some really strong ones, but you know, you've got to leverage existing. And you know, Bezos, he didn't write all the books, right? I mean, there's already, 10 zillion books, you know, you could buy, and he didn't have inventory of those books. But he had a website and said, if you want to buy books here, and then he'd go order the books and ship them to you, right? For he had some popular titles, but like he was leveraging so many existing things, right? A beautiful example, not to keep going on. I always laugh about Webvan back in the day. Webvan was like, hey, wouldn't it be a great idea to, you know, deliver groceries to people's house? Like, yeah, that's a great idea. It's a .com. It's 1999. I get an idea. Okay, great. Let's go build it, like, you know, $150 million warehouse. Let's get gorgeous, you know, trucks and refrigerate them because we're going to be picking up, going all around the city. And let's get drivers with uniforms. Let's go in. We'll stock the fridge and we'll do this. That's ridiculous. That thing failed before it even started. You know, and then you know, Instacart comes along and goes, hey, let's just go to Kroger and have some dude on a scooter, you know, dressed in jeans and a t-shirt and a backwards hat, you know, pick up your food and deliver it to your front door and run away. And somehow that creates a, you know, multi-decacorn business, you know, and they have really no infrastructure of owning or food and spoilage and warehouses and refrigerators and cars and trucks. And it's, you know, so they leveraged like 99 other things and created one thing in the middle to make something, you know, pretty amazing.
So this is very easy and chill. The fire round, I will have Steve answer. There's four questions. Steve will answer the first one first, and then Matt, and then we'll swap. So then whoever answers second has a little bit of time to think about the question. So Steve, what has been a personal highlight from 2023?
From 2023? Wow. Watching my two children grow and walk and talk and do great things. I have a 3-year-old and a 1-year-old, more or less. It's been incredible. So that's my biggest highlight.
I love it. And you almost got it where like the birth of the 1-year-old was part of it, but you missed it by like a week. So just watching you grow. I like that. Matt, exactly. What about you?
Well, it's a little trite for me to be talking about children's milestones because as you both know, I have an excessive amount of children. So I will use a work one, which is it was really gratifying to sell Corvus in 2023 to Travelers. InsurTech has had a rough time these past 3 years. And so having a great outcome like that for us, we invested alongside the founder in the pre-seed round and have been along for the full journey in that cybersecurity MGA. And I think they're going to do great things within Travelers, which is a company I hold in high regard. So that was a real highlight for me. seeing that team find such a good home.
Awesome. All right, Matt, you answer this one first. If you could have dinner with anyone, dead or alive, who would it be?
Winston Churchill.
I think someone else actually said that one too. I forget who, but I think he's someone we've had mentioned twice now.
My goodness. Well, I didn't mean to be so cliche. He's just a fascinating guy. Lived through very busy moments in history and was around the hoop for some of the most, you know, cataclysmic events in the 20th century. Is far from all good. He was a real colonialist and probably a racist and all those things. So I'd have some tough questions for him, but I'd love to hear some of his stories. And he has a great wine collection. So those are my reasons.
The real reason right there. Steve, what about you?
I would say, I have multiple answers, but, the one would be my mother. She's alive and well, but, I have to say her. Second, I was going to say my two kids when they're 50. That would be cool. Yeah, maybe Jesus or Gandhi. You know, I'll have a whole table full.
Yeah. There you go. I like the whole, like, it's dead or alive, but you've also picked someone that's alive, but, like, their future self. Very meta of you.
Exactly.
All right, Steve, you answer first on this one. When you're having a hard time, who's on your 911 list? Who do you call?
You know, I'd say probably my brother, Andy. You know, he works with me at FT Partners. He joined us, like, you know, almost like 18 years ago and, you know, moved his wife and family out to San Francisco to help me kind of get the business going. And he's been there ever since. So he's kind of my rock. So when, from business stuff and even personal stuff, you know, Andy's great. And as I would say, if I get myself in trouble or get lost somewhere, my other brother, Vinny. So my two brothers, I have an older and younger brother, so I'd call them in a pinch anytime.
Oh, you're a middle child. That explains so much now.
Oh, stop.
Matt, what about you?
I'd call my partner Merritt, I think, for a work problem. She is very smart, very empathic, knows, you know, me and all my situations quite well. She just is highly objective and very sensible. Always gives me good advice.
Awesome. All right. So last question, Matt, what's something that no one could find out about you, like by Googling Matt Harris?
It's going to be online now, Matt.
I know. I live a relatively public life. You know what is a pretty fundamental fact about me that's not online anywhere is my middle name.
My middle name is like a
top state secret. I never, ever use it. I always use my middle initial. So you could Google all you wanted and you would never find out my deep, dark secret middle name.
And you're not going to tell us now?
It's going to be in a large language model soon, Matt.
Yeah, exactly. I'm going to ask ChatGPT.
I will tell you guys.
Steve, what about you?
If you want to know.
Yeah, I want to know. Right. You made it sound like you weren't willing to share that information. Well, I feel like this is a very important milestone.
I mean, with Steve and Julie, I feel like my life's an open book with you guys. My middle name is Carmichael.
Was that like a family name or anything?
Yes, my mother's grandmother's maiden name was Carmichael. She called her Nana Carmichael, and it's my mother's, till I was born anyway, my mother's favorite human that ever lived. And so I got named after this legendary, I guess it'd be great-great-grandmother of mine.
Very cool. All right, Steve, what about you? What's a deep, dark secret that's not on the World Wide Web?
Deep, dark secret. those are all on the dark web. My first car I owned a 1980 Ford Fiesta, bright yellow, used. I think we bought it for $1,500. So there's a first car story.
Oh, yeah. My first car was a piece of shit, for a lack of better word. I had, like, the wind down windows, and they had to, like, reach over to go out and unlock the door. Oh, I hated that thing so much. I'd rather not have a car.
Yeah, this car, you had to get a running start to go up the hill.
All right, you beat me. All right, well, thank you so much again for coming on, you guys. I'm really excited for this episode and the rest of the episodes to come out. It'll be a bi-weekly, and you guys are the first episode. So you kick it off.
Exciting. No pressure. High five, virtual high five.
That's a real honor, Julie. We're both, I know, delighted to be here with you.
Bye. All right, well, thank you guys. Awesome. I appreciate it.
Thanks for putting up.
All right, thanks, Julie. Take care. See you later. Bye. Bye, guys.